need a different thing here. Sounds
funny.
Okay, the Legislative Commission on Surrogacy will come to order. It is Tuesday, June 28th, 2016 at 2 p.m. I am Senator Sandy Pappas. According to the legislation, I'm the convener of this commission. And why don't we start, because we have still a couple members who aren't here and one who's supposed to call in, why don't we just start with doing some introductions? So I introduce myself. I'm also from St. Paul. You're in my district. I represent the Capitol and downtown St. Paul and kind of surrounding neighborhoods. I've been a legislator for a long time. We won't say how many years. Let's include the staff here. Kathy.
I'm Kathy Pontius. I'm counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I handle family law issues, which is why I'm here.
I'm Senator Alice Johnson, and I live in Blaine, represent in District 37. And I was in the Minnesota House for 14 years, took a little hiatus and came back in 2012 and was in the Senate now for the first term. I'm very happy to be here.
Anna Wills, I'm a state representative in Apple Valley, Rosemount, and Coates, and serving in my second term, and a co-author on the legislation in the House that put this commission into law, and excited to be a part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Senator Carrie Rood, I represent Senate District 10, which is all of Aiken County and Crow Wing County, and I live in Breezy Point, so I kind of live in the God's country of the central of the state, so I'm glad to be here today.
Hello, my name is Amy Delwo. I work at the Department of Human Services. I'm here for Jim Koppel, who will actually be Commissioner Piper's designee. Since we're giving years of service, I've been with the department for about 18 years.
Hi, I'm Dan Pollack. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health. I'm a designee for Commissioner Ellinger. We're the public health agency and do a variety of work for early childhood and pregnancy and prevention work, and happy to serve on the commission.
I'm Richard Stebbins. I'm a district court referee in Hennepin County Family Court. Before that, I practiced family law for about 20 years in St. Paul.
I'm John Lesh, state representative here in St. Paul. I represent a little bit of the east side, north end, Tama Midway, and Como Park area of St. Paul. I've been in, this was my 14th legislative session.
And I'm Scott Dibble. I'm a state senator from Minneapolis and District 61. I represent Southwest, a little bit of South, a little bit of downtown Minneapolis, and I've been in the legislature, been in the Senate since 2003, and I've served in the House for one term, 2001-2002.
Hello, I'm second-term State Representative Cindy Pugh, representing Chanhassen and 9 of the 16 communities around Lake Minnetonka, and I also am a co-author on the legislation that created this commission, and I'm just delighted to be here.
I'm Representative Peggy Scott. I've just finished my 8th term. I guess I'm still in the middle of it, right, towards the end. And I was the author of the legislation that brought us here together. I'm looking forward to our work.
And I'm Mary Mullen, House, and I do family law issues.
And I'm Sally Olson with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and we'll be providing administrative support to the commission.
Okay, we have an agenda in front of us, and the first item on the agenda is the election of a chair. Then we're going to have a presentation from Ms. Pontius, some overview of legislative activity and court cases, and an overview of surrogacy laws. We had a lot more things we wanted to discuss today, but we didn't give our staff enough notice. And then we want to look at possible scheduling. Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I know you're interested in serving as chair, and I'm interested in you serving as chair. So I'd like to place your name in nomination if you're taking. If the floor is open for nominations.
Floor is open for nominations. Okay. Are there any other nominations? Then Ms. Wills, Representative Wills, right?
I would nominate that we have co-authors, the authors in both the House and the Senate, Senator Alice Johnson and Representative Peggy Scott.
Co-chairs, Alice Johnson. Can we do that, Greg? Go co-chairs? Okay. Alice Johnson and Peggy Scott. Are there any other nominations? Do I have to do that 3 times? Seeing none, nominations are closed. Then is there any proposal on how we want to do the election? People want to just raise their hands? Do people interested in secret ballots? can open Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to offer that I would like to be chair on this commission because I've worked very hard and was able to get it passed into law, and I really want to try to see that something, that there will be some action that we will be able to recommend to the next legislature, even though I won't be there, that someone, that we will bring something into law on the issue of surrogacy, which we need definitely in Minnesota. And so I'm asking that, you know, I think it's more logical that someone who is really supportive of this way of doing things, as myself and Senator or Representative Scott, that I think it would be very good for both of us to be doing it together. I'd appreciate your support.
Well, as long as we're giving speeches, I'll call myself. I believe it was Representative Lesh and I who actually authored the legislation to put in place a regulatory system for surrogacy, and we both have a long-time interest over many years in this issue. And we did have something passed a few years ago, I think that was vetoed in 2008. So many of us have issues that go way back on this, on the importance of having a regulatory system in place. So, yes, Representative Scott.
I guess I'm the only one that hasn't made a speech that's under nomination. So, no, I would appreciate your vote on this. Allison and I, Senator Johnson and I, did work hard on this legislation, and we have not come out publicly one way or the other as far as what kind of policy we would favor, and that's not necessarily true about the others in nomination, so I would just ask for your support.
Yes. Push the green.
Take a message.
Is that Senator
Hello?
Benson joining us?
Yes, this is.
All right. We just did introductions. If we could just take a pause for a minute, Representative Scott, and let Senator Benson introduce herself.
Yes.
Senator Benson.
I don't know what everybody else said, and I apologize for not being able to be there today. I'm looking forward to working with all of you on the commission. I currently serve on two human services committees and an energy environment committee, and I think I've been on every healthcare task force, so this will be a nice change of pace for me, and I'm glad to be here.
Okay, what you missed, Senator Benson, is we have nominations for chair. And once we elect a chair, that person will take over the meeting, and we have a pretty short agenda with a presentation from Senate Counsel on review of legislative activity and court cases on surrogacy and the overview of surrogacy laws and policies in other states. So right now we're on the election, and we've had nominated myself, Sandy Pappas. I'm just the temporary chair here today, potentially. And then the other nominees were co-chairs, Alice Johnson and Peggy Scott. Unfortunately, we checked on your ability to vote, Senator Benson, and it was determined by counsel that, unfortunately, you are not able to vote. But we appreciate you being here, and you certainly can contribute.
Senator Pappas, I need to hear the rule or statute.
We checked with both Senate and House counsel on this.
Yes.
And I'm
going
to need to hear the rule or statute.
We know.
It's a legislative custom to only permit members who are present to vote.
That's custom, and we can.
I'm sorry, do you heard what Mr. Hubinger said?
Yes, and he referred to custom.
Uh-huh.
He didn't refer to any specific rule or statute. And so I'm asking the body to make an exception to custom. I am not on vacation. I am not, you know, simply avoiding driving to St. Paul. My mother is being discharged from the hospital, and I'm trying to balance those two things. And so, since it is not in rule or in statute, I'm asking the body to raise questions.
Okay, yes, that is Representative Pugh.
Yes, Thank you, Senator Pappas. I would move that we consider this request by Senator Benson to allow consideration for her request to be considered an active voting member of this body. She is as present as she can be under the circumstances, and clearly, you know, isn't on vacation, and due to extenuating circumstances, is unable to be with us today. I know it was her intent to be here.
Before I take that motion, I just wanted to make two other announcements. One is that, unfortunately, Ms. Delro is not able to vote because she is not the official designee. She's sitting in for the designee, so she will not be able to vote. And Mr. Hubinger did just inform me that there was a precedence that someone on the Minsure Oversight Committee, a member, was allowed to vote because they were, you know, they just had a baby and they were in the hospital, not able to attend. And so I think we could consider Michelle Benson's situation to be very similar, is that she would be here if it weren't that she had this this family emergency. Okay, so as chair, I will just rule that Senator Benson can vote. Okay, then any suggestions on how we want to take the vote? Are we okay with Senator Dipple?
So it seems we've got kind of two things going on at the same time here. We have an idea of having co-chairs, I presume one from each chamber, one from each body, with only one nominee from the House. Would it make sense to separate the contests, and then have a, so we would effectively elect, I mean, if we all agree that that's a good idea, to have two chairs, I guess we need to ask that question first, and if we agree that that's a good idea, maybe by acclamation elect Representative Scott and then divide the contest between yourself and Senator Johnson.
I think that I can count, and that I will withdraw my nomination, and I'll recommend that we elect as co-chairs Representative Johnson, Senator Johnson, and Representative Scott. Is there anyone that has any objection to that? All right, then all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails, and I'll turn over the...
Madam Chair, before you leave, mm-hmm. I just want to thank you because I know that you, I've sat on many of your committees, and I know that you are a very good chair, and so I think I thank you for this. I sit on two other commissions where we have the House and the Senate co-chairing, and it mm-hmm. seems to be a very good cooperative way of doing things, and so I really appreciate that, and I respect you for that. Thank you.
Maybe I could just trade places with you, Alice.
Peggy, coming up there.
Sure. Bring my tent.
And the first thing that I would like to say is thank you, Senator Pappas, for being very diplomatic and willing to follow the rules as you see them clearly, and
that's my job.
I know you have done a great job in
follow the rules
in the 4 years that you've been here as president. I've seen that very often. So, again, thank you, members, for being here, and hopefully we will be able to come up with something that, as we become more informed on what is happening around the state and the United States and the world, that we will be ready to make decisions about this. So, Peggy, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to thank Senator Pappas, too, and I know you've invested a lot in this issue already, and we look forward to having your input on this committee, because it's our commission, because I know it'll be valuable. So thank you. Should we get on to our next
sure.
order of business? Ms. Pontius is going to give us kind of an overview of what is going on right now in the state of Minnesota, if there have been any cases on surrogacy in our state, and then an overview of what it looks like in other states as well. So thank you.
Madam Chair, as members, I understand these mics don't amplify, so raise your hand or something if you have trouble hearing me. I'll try to project.
And we should remember to try to speak up, because this room is very long, and it can be very difficult to hear sometimes.
The audience members might want to sit down here closer.
Yes.
So, Madam Chair, I thought I'd just start out briefly with kind of a sort of a history of where Minnesota's gone in the past. And most discussions on this issue start with the Baby M case, which I'm sure you're probably all familiar with. This is from 1988, but that was a New Jersey Supreme Court case which basically held that surrogacy agreement, a particular contract, was void as against public policy. And it refused to enforce a surrogacy contract. And this is sort of the classic case of an agreement gone wrong, where the mother, birth mother, had second thoughts. It was also a traditional surrogacy arrangement. She was also the biological mother in that case. And she decided to keep the child after birth, so there was litigation. Under the contract, the court said that it was void and unenforceable. However, what happened in that case was the intended parents went back and brought just a traditional kind of paternity action to get custody of the child, because the father was the biological father of the child, and they were awarded custody. So they got there through the paternity back door, so to speak, rather than enforcing that contract. And that was really that case, I think, brought to light for most people and legislatures around the country the fact that, first of all, surrogacy contracts were starting to occur. And there was, obviously reaction from both sides as to whether it was a good or bad idea. So in the Senate, I know, and I'm guessing similar activity probably took place in the House in 1988. In fact, there were a couple of bills introduced. One would have actually just said the contracts were void and unenforceable, period. I don't have the exact language of the bill anymore, but it was pretty, I think it was like maybe a couple sentences of that. Mm-hmm. And then the other one would have either, I think, didn't directly address the contracts, but addressed certain practices like advertising for surrogacy services, arranging surrogacy services, and things like that. So the Senate just had informational hearings on those bills, but nothing happened after that. And just briefly, before I go any further, on the whole distinction between traditional versus gestational surrogacy becomes important in a lot of the statutes. And the traditional case is the one where the mother is the biological mother of the child. Excuse me. And in gestational surrogacy, there is a third party. Either it's the mother, the egg of the mother, of the intended mother, or it could be a third-party donor. So the woman who's the gestational carrier does not have any biological relationship to the child. And at least among most experts and professionals will agree that the gestational approach is the best one to take, because first of all, the mother is much less likely to bond with the child if it's not a biological child, and then also if the contract isn't enforced from the perspective of the intended parents, they feel that they have a better chance in a paternity action if that ends up being the resort they have to take getting custody if the mother does not have a biological relationship with the child. So a lot of states distinguish based on the kind of contract that's involved. Some will allow one but not the other. And just among the professionals in the field, I think there are some, in fact, who they won't even consider doing a gestational surrogacy arrangement just because of the potential for problems down the road.
Traditional?
Yeah.
Traditional.
So they use a gestational, where the mother is a gestational carrier.
But you said they won't consider doing gestational. They won't consider doing gestational.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what I meant. Yeah.
We knew that.
Anna caught it.
Yes. The definitions are very important in this area of law, too.
And again, the traditional, it isn't the mother's, the woman's egg. Correct.
It is.
It is.
It's the carriers, the surrogates, egg. So it would use like artificial insemination as opposed to in vitro fertilization, which would be used if you have a gestational carrier.
Mm-hmm.
We have these definitions.
I see you've got one list of definitions. I know there are some different ones that are floating around. I'll get to this a little bit later. There are some actual definitions in current Minnesota law and the probate statutes. So that's one thing you need to think about as you're going along. But I think that at least gives you the sense of what the basic concepts are. And so I think from that the initial activity in 1988, there might have been a few informational hearings. I didn't do like a year-by-year analysis, but the first big jump I found was in 2008. And that's, I think, what you referenced earlier, where the legislature did pass the bill. Excuse me. Which would have established a legal framework for these arrangements and contracts. And the bill was vetoed by Governor Pawlenty. And it included, first of all, it amended, Minnesota does have an artificial insemination statute, but that goes way back to like 1980, I think, based on a Uniform Act. And it only deals with artificial insemination, but not embryo transfers. So the 2008 bill would have included all forms of assisted reproduction in terms of the paternity presumptions. It included eligibility requirements for both the carriers and the intended parents. For example, the gestational carrier would have to be at least 21 years old, have given birth to at least one child, would have to undergo like a medical and mental evaluation, legal consultation, have insurance company coverage. And it also did require that at least one of the intended parents have contributed sperm or egg to the child. So that's another issue that comes up as well. And then there were also a lot of just technical requirements for the contracts themselves. And there were also some provisions, amendments to the Parentage Act, just to clarify duty to support and how you would establish parentage. And in his veto message, Governor Pawlenty, acknowledged that these agreements are occurring and that it would be helpful to have legal parameters that, given how controversial the issue was and that there was actually bipartisan opposition, as he stated, that everything just really hadn't been resolved. So he vetoed the bill. And so then in 2010, there was a bill introduced in both the House and Senate that was kind of a narrower approach, sort of the back door, if you will, or the traditional Parentage Act amendments instead, without actually getting into issues related to the regulation of the contracts themselves. So you'd recognize who intended parents who enter into an agreement using assisted reproduction, they would have standing to go through the Parentage Act. There might be provisions where they could even get orders ahead of time to establish parentage. But it was silent on the actual requirements of the contracts themselves. It just referred to these written agreements. And the bill passed, I think, both the House and the Senate policy committees, and it passed the House floor, but then remained on the Senate floor at the end of the year. Now, an interesting side note, in that same year, there was a law that passed in the probate code that dealt with assisted reproduction, but it only applies to the parent-child relationship for purposes of inheritance and intestate succession. But if you look in the probate code, you'll see right now there are definitions of assisted reproduction, birth mother, child of assisted reproduction, genetic father, mother, gestational agreement, all those are terms that are defined for probate law purposes, but they're not anywhere else in statute. Mm-hmm. One other point of that law is that it did...
May I interrupt?
Oh, sure.
On that, on the probate thing, part of it was the inheritance, and so do the children have any other rights at all granted to them in terms... I'm thinking of... knowing who their parents are.
Madam Chair, the law did not get into that in terms of birth records, so there was no change to that. It was really narrow, just a probate law focus.
So the children were adopted by the couple who had?
In these cases, this was just in terms of how they would inherit under the law. So there might have been different situations. If there are there's special provisions dealing with children who are adopted,
okay,
and their rights under probate law as well. So. But that law itself, though, did explicitly state in a separate section that it did not affect Minnesota law regarding gestational agreements, which there isn't really any Minnesota law regarding. Mm. I think they want to make it clear that the intent was just to at least establish some kind of a framework for this particular purpose. And then in 2013 and 2014, there were a couple things going on. I think the Bar Association actually had a bill. Again, it was a narrow approach that attempted to amend the Paternity Act to give intended parents under a written agreement standing to establish their paternity and assert their rights as parents under the paternity law. Again, it didn't get into the actual mechanics or details of the contracts themselves. The status of the parties, requirements for the parties, and things like that. It just said if there was a written agreement under which they were intended to parents, then that would give them at least a foot in the door under the Parentage Act. And the original bill failed to pass in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And a lot of the opposition focused on the fact that it sort of recognized the legitimacy of these agreements without laying out any parameters for it. But then the next year, the Senate passed another bill, which included those Paternity Act amendments, but then also had a separate article that was added that specifically addressed gestational carrier agreements. So it actually had substantive law in it, somewhat similar to what was vetoed in 2008. I think one significant difference, I didn't go through every little point, but I think that the 2008 law would have applied or did not include the requirement that the mother not be biologically related to the child, and because of concerns regarding recognizing the traditional surrogacy contracts, the 2014 bill that passed said the mother could not be biologically related to the child. So that was one difference there. The House had passed, the companions just didn't quite match up. Basically, the House passed Paternity Act amendments that went to the House floor, but it didn't pass the amendments that were actually addressing the contracts themselves. So nothing happened. And then finally, I think in 2015, I think you introduced a bill, Senator Pappas, that would have, again, established requirements for the surrogacy arrangements without Parentage Act amendments, but although I think the way the bill is structured, it addressed all the Parentage Act issues right in the operative language itself. But and I think that might be the one that Representative Lesch co-authored in the House, I'm not sure. But no hearings were held in any on that. So that's kind of the latest thing that's happened. And then in the meantime, there's not a lot of case law in Minnesota either. There have been two Minnesota Court of Appeals cases that they've addressed issues arising out of surrogacy contracts, but neither directly considered the legality of agreements under Minnesota law or requirements for agreements to be enforceable. The first was a 2007 opinion, and this involved a single man from New York who used in vitro fertilization and a gestational surrogate who was from Minnesota to have a child. The surrogate was not biologically related. They did have a surrogacy agreement that contained their intentions, and also included a provision stating that it was governed by Illinois law. Illinois is one of the states that's sometimes cited as kind of a good model to look at and somewhat predictable in terms of its requirements. And so what the issue that the Court of Appeals was actually looking at, again, this was a case where the surrogate decided to maintain parental rights, and so the man sued for parentage and custody. So the question in that case was really just whether the court properly applied Illinois law. And the Court of Appeals said, yes, under the choice of law principles, that was the law to apply. So it wasn't directly decided under Minnesota law. The one thing that's worth taking note of is that there was also an argument raised that even under choice of law, if one state is applying the law of the other of another state, it can decline to do so if it would violate, say, the public policy of Minnesota. So that argument was made in that case. But the Court of Appeals said that there was no Minnesota legislative or judicial law prohibiting these agreements, and that there was no articulated public policy, so it declined to fall back on that public policy exemption, and it applied the Illinois law, which made the agreement enforceable. And then the second case came up again, which is the Minnesota Court of Appeals in 2010. This involved, there was a traditional surrogacy contract with a woman entered into with two men. She actually surrendered the child and then later tried to assert her rights as a parent under the Parentage Act. And in that particular case, they just used a Parentage Act analysis and concluded that she was the legal and biological mother without getting into the underlying surrogacy agreement issues, but then went on to find that it would be in the child's best interest and upheld the district court to award the biological father sole legal and physical custody. So the biological father got the custody basically under a Parentage Act principles as opposed to the surrogacy contract. Again, though, the Court of Appeals noted that there's no legislation or case law in Minnesota that deals with the legal effect of these arrangements, and that it involves questions of public policy best resolved by the legislature. And it also noted that either way, that the whole enforceability issue wasn't raised, so from a procedural point of view, it wasn't properly before the Court of Appeals.
Ms. Pontius, in that case, where you mentioned that it was a case between a traditional surrogacy, it was her egg, was one of the men that were the biological father then?
The Representative Scott, yes. And so that's how that was the hook under the
Parentage Act.
One of the men was.
All right.
And just, I haven't done, there's a lot of material on what other states have done. And, but I thought at first, I think just based on the discussion of what's been in the Minnesota bills, I've just kind of put together a laundry list of sort of key legal issues that you want to think about, and also things that are addressed in laws in other states. Obviously, the first question is whether you want to prohibit explicitly surrogacy contracts or whether you want to permit them, and if so, the circumstances under which you do. There are some states that still have statutes that prohibit surrogacy contracts, but most either allow them or have allow them with certain parameters that have to be met. There's also a distinction made, as I mentioned earlier, between traditional surrogacy, where the surrogate is the biological mother, versus gestational, where the surrogate is not biologically related to the child. Some states will, and statutes will allow the agreements only in cases where the surrogate is not biologically related. Another issue to think about is compensation of surrogates. States vary on that. Some, I think most will at least allow compensation for actual medical expenses and health care expenses, but they get into a little more differences when you go beyond that. I think the latest Minnesota legislation referred to reasonable compensation. So that's another thing to think about. And then also you have just parameters sort of governing the parties to agreements, sort of things that you probably would consider in most cases, requiring medical health evaluations. I know at least the bills that have been considered in Minnesota have required the physician certify that there be some kind of a medical need for assisted reproduction, so it would not just be done as a matter of convenience, say, but the parties, the intended parents would have to show that they had a medical need for it. The characteristics of the character and intended parents in terms of their age, legal consultation, that's pretty standard provision, and then also health insurance or medical expense coverage requirements. And then there's also just more technical contractual requirements to include, obviously contracts in writing, witness, perhaps executed by all parties, usually if either the intended parents are may or may not be a married couple, but if they have spouses who aren't intended parents, they would have to be joined in the contract. Also, if the surrogate was married, the surrogate spouse would have to consent as well. Those are common provisions. And then just sort of a general issue is just the regulatory approach that you take. There's a few states that actually criminalize, I think, surrogacy contracts, but that doesn't seem to be a favorite approach. But the biggest issue is just enforceability and the kind of remedies that are available. Like the recent Minnesota legislation has been fairly general. It says you can't require specific performance under a contract, which means you can't require the mother to carry the baby to term either way. But it just has a general statement that you can bring an action for other remedies available under law. So the question would be whether you want to be more specific than that or not. And as far as other states, as I mentioned, there's not a uniform approach. It's a patchwork quilt based on all these different issues. And most of the law is statutory, although some of it's come from court cases dealing with the enforceability of these agreements. So there's a lot of information out there, and we can certainly put it together in a more systematic fashion. I kind of scribbled out my notes here for now, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Pontius, do you happen to have a copy of the bill? I thought maybe we'd have one here today, but do you have a copy of the bill that actually passed the legislature and was signed into law? And the reason I ask is I just wanted to go over what we've been tasked with.
I have it.
Ms. Olson.
I have one also. Okay.
Is this something for everybody?
Yep.
Oh, she's got one coming. Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you. I'll wait till everybody has a copy. Thank you for that overview. Very informative.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Is there a possibility of having some data presented in terms of the numbers, and this could be a future meeting, how many do you think are happening in Minnesota or nationally, and then perhaps a presentation about the outcomes, if percentage that resulted in litigation or happy family, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that would be great if we can get our hands on it. And I don't know if such data exists, but does the Department of Health and the birth records, is there any indication whether a child is born under surrogacy or not?
Madam Chair, I will ask. Off the top of my head, I don't know, and I don't think that we would include that kind of thing because the birth record is statutory. So if state law doesn't recognize surrogacy, then we probably wouldn't have that in the birth record.
Yeah.
I'd like to it kind of took a little bit. I was on a task force just last week, and on that task force, the chair asked us to talk about either what we want, what we would like to have as information. Also, gave us the word expectations, and it seemed to really bring out a lot from each member of the task force. And so I think maybe at some point in this meeting, when it's appropriate, that we would each at least be able to say, this is something I would like to know about. And if you want to talk about an expectation, mm-hmm. that would be okay. If you,
yeah. No, I think that's.
So I think the question that was asked by Mr. Pollack, right?
Yes.
I think that's an example mm-hmm. to, and what you had talked about. We need to know how many.
Right. So if you see on, this is part of the omnibus bill. It looks like. So page 267.13 outlines our duties there. And so it says that these are topics for study, but it's not limited to this list. So we're certainly open to jotting down, as Mr. Pollack brought up and as co-chair
Johnson brought up other topics that, you know, more other information that we'd like to get our hands on so that we can make the best decisions here, put forth the best policy as possible. But so the on 267.17, the list actually begins. So potential health and psychological effects and benefits on women who serve as surrogates, potential health and physical effects and benefits on children born of surrogates, business practices of the fertility industry, including attorneys, brokers, and clinics, considerations related to different forms of surrogacy, considerations related to the potential exploitation of women in surrogacy arrangements, contract law implications when a surrogacy contract is breached, potential conflicts with statutes governing private adoption and termination of parental rights, potential for legal conflicts related to third-party reproduction, including conflicts between or amongst the surrogate mother, the intended parents, the child, insurance companies, and medical professionals, public policy determinations of other jurisdictions with regard to surrogacy, and information to be provided to a child born of surrogate about the child's biological and gestational parents. And if you go on there, we are due to give the legislature a full report by December 15th of this year. So we have a lot of work ahead of us. Are there any other comments, any other things that, in addition to this list, that people would like to see added? And we'll try to ask this question at future meetings, too, so that if you have time to noodle on this a little bit and you come up with some, oh, this would be really helpful information to have, we will certainly ask that. Yes, sir.
You know, and
Mr. Stebbins.
I don't know how to address anybody in the context of the Senate, so I'll just probably use your names. Mm-hmm. Everyone should know that these cases are being heard in court. There's hundreds of cases that have been heard through Minnesota courts, and there are hundreds of cases that are being controlled, usually from county to county or judicial officer to judicial officer in a somewhat ad hoc way. There are many professionals, attorneys who know what they're doing, who walk the courts and everyone else through the process, and then the courts have to gauge whether or not it's a sufficient process to have it done, but there's no legislative basis for it, and that's a problem because there's no uniformity. There's probably questions about equal protection and different things like that, but there are issues of adjudication of paternity, termination of parental rights, adoption, step-parent adoption, that all have to be addressed in the context of these cases, and they're usually being done, I think, in a well-supervised way by the courts, but because there's no legislative basis for it, it's not uniform from county to county, and it's not uniform among the states in our region or our country either. So that's all I'll add.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
So you can refer to us as the Right Honorable Your Worship.
He's only half joking.
He'll do the same. He'll do the same.
I forgot my wig and my robe.
You're exhausted.
Robe doesn't guarantee that that's the way you address you.
So Referee Stebbins kind of raised a little bit of. I don't know if I have anything to add to the list. I might, as my thinking mm-hmm. matures on this. But in terms of the sources and the ways in which we gather information, if we could, well, certainly we're going to hear a lot, I'm sure, from you, but if you have thoughts and ideas of other practitioners to bring in to hear from in the form of mm-hmm. Testimony or written materials to help us really hone in on the issues that get raised on a daily basis in people's mm-hmm. lives in our state. Some of the practical stuff. Thanks. So we can hear from attorneys and other practitioners mm-hmm. In the form of testimony. That would be great. I know of one in particular, actually, who was the attorney representing the men from the 2010 or 2011 appeals case, Suzanne Bourne. It would be great to bring her in. I know that in my little bit of homework that I did to prepare for this first meeting, the American Bar Association, I assume Minnesota Bar, has some model policy proposals, model legislation, if we could either review that in writing or hear from representatives from the Bar Association, that would be extremely useful.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Certainly the comments from Mr. Stebbins made me think, yes, I think this is an important part for us to get information from something that's happening in our state. So I think it fits in with what you're talking
right.
about.
And Referee Stebbins, not to put you on the spot here, but is there a common thread of what those cases are going to court over right now? Is it the parentage rights? What is it all over the map, or is there one that kind of seems to be rising to the top?
Well, I mean, by and large, most of these cases that go through the court system are dealing with a contractual surrogate relationship with the proposed parents, and an adoption needs to take place, or an adjudication of paternity, and or a termination of parental rights. It's very rare among the hundreds of cases that have been before the court. It's my understanding, just from people that I know have represented them before the court and judicial officers who have heard these cases, it's rare when there are any types of disputes. It's a contractual relationship, and the contracts vary from case to case and attorney to attorney for the parties. So therein lies part of the problem. But most of the time, the intent of both the proposed parents and the gestational carrier are carried out by the courts.
Representative Flesh.
So I'm struck by, when I read the list under subdivision 5, what appears to me a glaring absence on that list of 10, which is the reasons or benefits to parents who want to have children. And I guess I was wondering why that was left out. Was it the reason because there's assumption that that drive of parents wanting to raise children is the reason why we're here in the first place, so therefore we don't need to talk about it. But it strikes me that we've got these psychological effects and benefits of women, on women who serve in surrogates, benefits and psychological effects on children, business practices of the fertility industry. Nowhere in that list does it say anything about parents who want to have the kids, and it just seems to me that that is something that really ought to be considered, and we ought not just assume, well, parents are always going to want to have kids. That is, of course, what is generating the legal conflict, but I was just surprised when I saw that absence. I wondered if anyone could give me a reason in the context of the legislative discussions as to why that was left out.
I don't have an answer for you other than the fact that it is kind of a given that the whole reason for surrogacy is because people want to have babies or they want to have children. So I don't know. I wrote that down on a piece of paper, you know, in my notes here, to definitely hear from those folks. And I think we've all heard from those folks in our own districts that are, you know, they want to have children and they see this as a way to have that happen. So, I don't know.
Well, the reason I brought up, Madam Chair, was because there's obviously emotional testimony of folks who want to have children. But on the other side of the ledger on this list, we're going to be measuring that against all the scientific reasons of why maybe they shouldn't want to. And I think maybe there ought to be some scientific reasons of why they should as well. That's
sure.
The only reason I was bringing it up.
You bet. Thank you.
Representative Lesh, and that's why we say they are not limited to these 10 things, because it's difficult to get a perfect piece of legislation brought out, and especially as something as controversial as this. And the intended parents is that is one segment of this whole issue that has been very important. I'm very much in favor of that myself, the psychological, and just to look at the people who are having children and seeing that they're fit and they're not going to be used children for improper use, which we see happen sometimes. But no, I would agree with you. I think we have to listen to what the intended parents have to say.
You bet. Anybody else have anything to add to the list? Representative Wills.
Thank you. I was thinking about what Referee Stebbins said about the hundreds of cases, and I'm assuming that by the very nature of them being in court, that they have a contract that they've come up with of some sort. And I'm wondering if there's any way we could have data, if it's collected or if it's available, on those cases, if there is a contract that's been in place, and if there was a contract, whether it was just, you know, friends helping friends, or if it was more of a commercial situation where it was seeking out more of a business that helps facilitate that arrangement. So we can kind of see, if possible, which one is more frequent, if we can even find that out. I just think that would be helpful.
Yeah.
Anybody else? All right.
I would just refer to number 9 under here, public policy determinations of other jurisdictions with regard to surrogacy. And I think there could be, I mean, it would remind me of some of the groups that are coming, have come before us, the people who, agencies who provide those sort of services for people. I think mm-hmm. that should be looked into and determined about what kind of rules and guidelines there might be.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I thought other jurisdictions might mean other states. Yeah. Maybe that's part of
that's
it, too.
That too, yeah.
I was thinking of jurisdiction as a different thing. mm-hmm. Anyway, back to other agencies that would be involved in surrogacy should be.
Okay.
Like child welfare agencies or?
Or the, if I can look back on some of the people that we had talked to us earlier.
Like agencies that do surrogacy contracts, is that what you're referring
mm-hmm,
to?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, hopefully everybody has their calendar. That's the next agenda item here. And let's see.
Have to do a monkey survey.
we may have to do that. Survey Monkey or Google Docs or one of those. Mm-hmm. What's that? That's it. Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Is there any special day that works or time that has that been? I don't know if Sally, did you use? Didn't you?
Sally?
Just kind of randomly pick time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think you gave us a choice of 3 or 4, and we chose from that. So
again, from the other task force that I was on, it was everyone agreed to the same day of the week and the hour, and then went from dates.
Right.
So that could be a beginning way to determine if there is anything that would work instead of every month, or if is it going to be monthly or whatever.
Senator Pappas.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, my staff just reminded me is that I'd gotten some requests from the public if we could meet at like 4 o'clock, that at the end of someone's work day, we might get more participation from the public instead of having them interrupt their work day.
Okay.
Although those of us from Greater Minnesota then have to stay a whole nother night. I mean, if you start your day at 4 o'clock, it's you know.
Mm-hmm. It's too far
difficult
for you to drive back. You can't drive that morning and then drive back the next day.
Hit a deer.
You're trying to do it in one day.
Well, it's you know, it's a lot easier if I don't have to take 2 days for one meeting. Mm-hmm. And so when you do it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it just makes it a little more difficult rather than just doing it within the business day.
It would be a little difficult for support staff. I don't know.
If we do a 3 to 5, Representative Pugh?
Madam Co-Chair, I think that the suggestion that was just made is a good one to allow for however long our meeting is going to last, that maybe toward the end of the meeting is when the testimony could be, so that the public knew when it would be. And then maybe, you know, a member could be here early and still get home. But I also just recently had an experience with one of those technology where you, whatever it's called, I don't know what it's called, but you just fill in. And I was working with members from other states on different time zones, and it was just amazing how quickly it comes together, just plugging in one's availability. And, you know, just technology could be really useful here rather than somebody just taking a look at all of our limited availability, which is really going to be a patchwork. So
we have a couple people missing too.
Right.
Yeah. So
right.
I would just encourage us to consider doing that. It would probably be really easy to find some good times.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I do think, though, we have to have some parameters because, you know, to have open calendars. I mean, basically, when I set up this meeting, I looked at, you know, time slots that I was available, quite
mm-hmm.
frankly. And then we asked everyone to pick from those time slots. So.
And there is a function called a doodle where somebody can put in time ranges and dates and then distribute an email to everybody who's invited to contribute. And that way you can see where you get the highest probability of people being able to attend. I've used it for a number of meetings. So I think that's something similar to what
we
were talking about, but it was really quite helpful.
But you can't have 30 options.
Yeah.
You have
yeah.
like 10 options.
Well,
maybe if we talk about the 4 o'clock time and rule it up or rule it down, that is there anyone that would be, I mean, how many people would like to have it at 4 o'clock?
Oh, what were you, Sandy?
I think I'm going to say. Would you guys, the folks that are for the 4 o'clock, could you do a 3 to 5 so that staff could go home at 5?
That's fine.
3
yeah,
to 5?
I'm not raising my hand because I'm flexible. So
okay.
I'm
Representative Applebaum, would that work for you?
That's fine.
Okay. So maybe we do a 3 to 5 and then allow at least some folks hopefully getting off work. And I like the idea of doing that because then at least that part of it's consistent. It may not, the day of the week or month may not always be consistent, but at least if we know that we have a 4 to 6, or I mean a 3 to 5 starting time.
We can always change it if there's no public around.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we will have staff then get out a Google Doc or something, Google Calendar, whatever it's called, Doodle. Maybe it's called Doodle.
Survey Monkey.
Or Survey Monkey. To everybody, and then we'll try to get the next meeting scheduled as soon as possible. I know it's summertime and people have vacations and those sorts of things to plan, so we will try to do that. And I don't know, I look at this list of things that we've been charged with, I'm not sure one meeting a month is going to cover it. I think we're going to need to meet probably twice a month. And I understand people will kind of just have to plan accordingly. Sometimes you're just not going to be able to make it because you're on vacation or other obligations.
Is there any special day that anybody is? Tuesday? Is it a good day? Is there another date? Mr.
Stebbins?
Friday typically works better for the courts because we reserve time to write orders that day. So.
Pardon me? Okay, you said.
Fewer cases are scheduled on Fridays.
I thought the judges were
that's probably the worst day.
Yeah.
Back in the 70s, yeah.
Sorry.
Anybody else?
What was it, Friday, you said, Mr. Stebbins?
Fridays are better for me, that's all I can say, but you know, I'm in town here, so I can't take.
I don't think most people would like Friday.
Fridays from 4 to 6 in the summer in Minnesota. Yeah.
But I understand.
Yeah,
that.
Absolutely. I know Fridays are better for the courts for sure. Well, anybody else have any particular day? Anna? I mean, excuse me. Representative Wills?
Just a comment that if Fridays are good for the courts to be able to present, we could maybe set one or two meetings specifically on a Friday for them to present, but not necessarily for all our meetings on Fridays.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Pappas, did you have your hand up?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that I know some of us have 40 and 4-day work schedules in the summer where people work 4-day weeks,
mm-hmm.
and that means they're probably off of a Friday or off of a Monday.
Yeah.
So I would suggest in the summer we might look at staying within Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. In the fall, it's more flexibility, I think.
So maybe do the same thing that you did, Senator Pappas, put out 3 days and see how many people can come at that time. Or
Ms. Olson can do that for
yeah.
us.
We'll get something out. Because I want to get these scheduled as much as we can. that people can set aside and get decided on.
And even 10, we have the, what is it, maximum of 10 meetings, I think it is. And so, you know, it's the months go by really quick. Mm-hmm. And we have a few things going on and
right.
a lot of people's lives.
Yeah,
as
right.
it gets to November, October and November, there are a lot of people that will be working on campaigns, I suppose.
So if there are any other suggestions, feel free to pipe in. I think I'd like to sit down with my co-chair and take, you know, these objectives and get them scheduled on the calendar. And so we'll know what the specific topics will be for any given meeting. So we'll try to get on top of that really soon, and so we can start getting testimony lined up and so that the public is aware of what the topic will be.
I would like to hear from people if we have time yet. It's 3 o'clock, we have time, I think, mm-hmm. To hear about what a suggestion that you might have, if you have one, of something that you would like to hear, have someone to come in to inform us about. As Michelle, Senator.
Yes, I'm going to hang up and thank everybody for accommodating me today, but I'm going to terminate my part of the call. So thank you all very much. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Anybody?
So
Senator Dibble.
If I understand the question, you're asking for individuals who might serve as information resources for
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm. Especially if they fit into what we are looking at, but otherwise not limited to that, remember.
I'm sorry, what?
I said, you know, as it looks to the duties that we have,
right.
but there's certainly room for other
right,
things, too.
Right. So I think I mentioned Suzanne Bourne, who's a family law attorney.
And it would be regarding, and tell us what you would expect Suzanne to tell us about.
I think she can step us through the challenges that people in Minnesota have in entering into enforceable contracts.
And is it B-O-R-N or B-O-U-R-N, like Jason?
Nope, it's like birth.
Okay.
B-O-R-N.
It's a good name for
yeah.
surrogacy lawyer.
That's a good point. I never thought about that. In fact, if we have time, I'm going to have this. This is a great article that I ran across from the ABA that kind of uses that case that Ms. Pontius just talked about as an illustration of the issues and the legal problems. So I'm going to step out and have my staff make
sure.
copies for all of us.
Sure. Perfect. Thank you.
Senator Giblet, would you like my staff to take that for you so you don't have to leave?
Madam Chair, this is not a complete answer, but the vital records staff do have some information about surrogacy status on the birth record. It's basically a voluntary process. All birth record information is voluntarily collected at the point of birth by the hospital. So if the birth parent tells the hospital that this is a birth that's resulting from surrogacy, that would be information included. So we may have some statistics that I could share at a future meeting.
Okay.
Because it's voluntary, it's incomplete, and it wouldn't necessarily be comprehensive for the state.
Right, right. Anybody else? And we may think, you know, after we get into some of our future meetings, our minds will get going and we'll think of other people. It would be good to hear from XYZ. So we'll leave that.
Also, at any time, you know, to contact mm-hmm. either Sally or one of us and talk about it. And when you find something that's very useful, that you believe will be useful for the commission, I think we should be open to do looking at it, anyway, that's for sure.
Right. Representative Wills.
Just a question on procedure. Are we going to have set aside time at each meeting that's open to the public to comment at all, or is that going to be at any meetings, like specific meetings, or is that not included in
I think,
the
you know,
jurisdiction of the commission?
I think we'll definitely have an agenda, and we'll hear from people within the field. I think we can probably conduct it somewhat like a legislative committee hearing and just have a certain amount of time at the end, and you just allow for public testimony. Now, if the public is signing up ahead of time, then definitely, and they're getting on the calendar, then we'll allow for that. But usually try at the end of a meeting, you know, to ask if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to testify. So we'll certainly allow for that.
Good. And this is a question I would ask of staff. We have the rules that you have to set out the meeting dates and times and places and so forth to the public.
Okay. Yes.
So that how, a 24-hour, is that what you need?
Madam Chair, we try to provide 3 days' notice for
3 days? Okay.
And if I...
Yes, Senator Dibble.
And is that then stuck on, placed on the commission website?
Madam
Mr. Huebinger.
It's posted on the legislative calendar, so it's on both the House and the Senate and the legislative calendars.
What is that? What does that mean?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, the legislature, the House and Senate each have their own websites.
Oh,
there's also a state legislative website, each with their calendars. The legislative website has all three, the House, the Senate, and the joint.
Okay, thank you.
Essence, it'll be in three spots.
Okay, great.
Yep.
Are we going to ask anybody in the audience to speak at all?
Right now?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's up to you. I'll let you make that call.
Well, if there is some time.
I've made a mistake and never introduced people in the audience. Maybe you might want to do that.
We want to do that.
Yeah, just say why they're here.
That was what I was going to ask, if there was anyone in the audience that might want to say something to us about what they would either expect or like to get information, either to enlighten us or to ask questions about what we're doing.
Just want to just go on.
Sure. If you're willing and to do it, if you care to, Senator Pappas suggested that since we have, I'd say, another half hour and then we can cut it off, but everyone here that wishes to introduce themselves, we would appreciate that. I would appreciate that. Senator Pappas would appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. I think we all
Scott
would.
If you would like to. And very briefly, just tell us who you represent if you care to. Steve?
I'm Steve Snyder. I'm an attorney that's been practicing reproductive law in Minnesota for 30 years. I've been the chair of the American Bar Association Assisted Reproductive Technology Committee for 7 years, and I helped draft and pass the American Bar Association Model Act on Assisted Reproductive Technology.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, we definitely want to hear from him.
I definitely suspect we
yeah.
will.
I'm Very Callie Lehman. I'm respectful. The committee administrator for the Civil Law Committee in the House.
I'm just an interesting
okay.
citizen.
Say your name, though, please.
That's
Ashley
okay.
Can I just note, Madam Chair, just for the record,
yep.
I don't feel like in commissions we should be putting citizens who come here to view the proceedings in a position to have to state their name.
On the spot, yeah.
So
yeah.
if
That's
I just
true.
Would prefer that. If
you can pass.
They want to.
Well,
Thank
of course,
you.
Anyone can pass. No one has to talk about anything they want to. But if you'd like to.
Go ahead.
I'm Tom Lehman. I spell my name correctly, unlike Callie. On one end. And I'm here on behalf of Resolve, the National Infertility Association.
Anyone else that wishes to inform us about you? If not, we appreciate very much, and maybe that wasn't a good thing to do, but it wasn't meant to embarrass anyone at all. But if anyone wants to show their interest, they can.
Okay.
Yep. Okay,
this
and
bad.
Okay.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be on this side of the microphone. Kathy Tengelstad, former legislator. I served in the House from 1997 to 2008, and very interested in this topic. As you went through the history of this legislation, I indeed was the chief author of that bill in 2008 that passed the House and Senate, was unfortunately vetoed, but as staff outlined earlier, there were things in the veto message that said, you know, we do need some parameters on this legislation. And as I hear about the court cases and other things that have happened since 2008, I just really wish that it would have been signed into law that year, because there's a lot of things that probably could have been avoided if those procedural safeguards had occurred at that time. I know there was a message about bipartisan opposition to it. You know, it was one of those bills that was passed on one of the last days in session, and, you know, long hours, crazy times. I mean, we had co-authors who voted against it because we just voted so quickly on the floor that, you know, people know how it works on the House floor anyway. Oh, yeah. But I do want to serve as a resource to this commission. I have a long background in this area, as my husband and I went through infertility, and I served as president of the local resolve group. But also as a Christian, as a conservative, I'm very interested in this area, and obviously continue to follow this group and would like to talk to any of you individually as well as far as things as you proceed. I think it's really important, the people that you do bring in who are able to make comments on this. I'm a little concerned that because there's not a lot of publicity on this, that people who may be considering doing this type of parenting may not know about it and would like to, I'm sure, have their opinion heard. So, again, I just really appreciate it. I'm here as a private citizen today. I'm retired from lobbying as well, and so totally as a volunteer and with a big interest and a big heart on this issue. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Engelstad.
Senator, Representative Applebaum came in a little late, and so if you'd like to introduce yourself to the rest of us, especially to me, because I don't think I've ever met you personally.
Okay. Hi, John Applebaum, State Representative from District 44B, which is Minnetonka, Plymouth, Woodland. Finished my first term and running for re-election. Excited to be on the commission, learning more about this topic and working with all of you and others to form some sensible solutions and guide policy on this growing area of law.
Thank you for being here. Senator Dibble, you distributed this article?
Yes.
You didn't sign it.
That's verbally. I call it, I distributed the underline part of it, so the underlines are more for myself, but this is where some of the key issues are captured in those last couple of pages.
Thank you.
Okay. Nice to have it already highlighted.
Yes.
Well, we appreciate that. Any other comments specifically you'd like to discuss?
Well, I thought it was interesting.
FYI for all of us.
So the article, you know, of course, is written to a national audience, but uses this one case in Minnesota to illustrate the issues that get raised when there's a lack of legal foundation and structure in a given state, and, you know, kind of what, you know, what they ran into. So it was a traditional surrogacy, and the mom came back a month later to assert her parental rights. And so then off to the courts they went. And I think ultimately, if I remember correctly, help me, Ms. Pontius, it wasn't really the contract which was the determinant of the outcome of the case. It was existing parental law. So they highlight some of the mistakes. They went about it without any, they went into it pro se, so no legal counsel. So that was mistake number one. I think they went through some sort of a surrogacy online registries and connected with a woman with whom they had no relationship or prior knowledge or connection or any sort of, you know, had no foundation to know anything about her. No sort of screening. And of course, they did it in a state where there was just no legal framework for entering into that sort of an agreement. And so then it goes on to draw some of the larger conclusions. Some ideas out there. I think Referee Stebbins talked about a federal framework would be helpful. Of course, we can't do much about that here. It talks a little bit about Uniform Parentage Act Article 8 of the ABA model, in which there are a couple of different approaches, requiring approval by a court to a gestational agreement, similar to an adoption proceeding. But only two states have adopted that Article 8 of this uniform law to date. It includes things like verifying the mother's qualifications to carry, intended parents' qualifications to be parents, deals with issues around compensation, deals with issues around the agreement and the power to terminate the agreement. Some states stipulate that if an agreement hasn't been approved by a judge, it is not enforceable. That's to provide an incentive to go to court ahead of time to approve these contracts. And then providing a flexible framework around parentage, informed consent, mental health consultation, privacy, insurance issues, alternatives for no judicial involvement in which at least one of the parents has a genetic link, resulting in all parties submitting to eligibility and procedural requirements, et cetera. So it provides some ideas, some lessons to be drawn, and some ideas for some choices that we might be able to make as a commission.
We appreciate this, and we'll definitely be reading through that and picking out some ideas out of that are relative to what we're doing. Well, all of it's probably relative, so thank you for bringing that today. Are there any other further comments? Senator Johnson, you have the gavel, so I'll let you.
Okay, any other questions? I think we'll be getting information out as quickly as possible about the next meeting. I would guess that we probably will be more like two per month, and that'll be, then we will provide you with an agenda as to what we would believe would be the next effort that we would take. So with that, question?
Right.
Okay, comments?
Ms. Bonnies, we're going to formalize your report a little bit and distribute that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, sorry. It's close to that, so I can do that.
Okay, great. Thanks. I saw Representative Wills and Representative Pugh writing really great notes, and I was feeling bad. And then I thought, I'll just make Kathy write it up. And then
I think it would be better to get the information from Ms. Pontius than my notes. With that, meeting is adjourned. Thank you.